Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, can the Democratic governor strike a deal with Republican lawmakers to extend education funding into the future? And how Sedona became the New Age capital of America. But first, as the Trump administration threatens mass deportations across the country, restaurant workers are on guard. Immigrants, documented or not, make up a big chunk of the restaurant industry. Here in Arizona, the Migration Policy Institute says that adds up to around 23,000 undocumented immigrants. Chefs and restaurant owners are handing out cards, posting notices in kitchens, informing workers of their rights, and preparing for potential questions from ICE. And many have not wanted to talk to the press about their concerns. But our first guest this morning told me he doesn't see anything controversial about speaking out. Chris Bianco is probably Arizona's best known chef. The James Beard Award winner owns two pizzerias in Phoenix, plus Trotto and Pane Bianco here in the Valley, as well as a newer location in Los Angeles. He told me he always follows the law. He uses E-Verify to make sure the people he hires have legal status to work in the U.S. But he says there are ripple effects from threats of mass deportations and immigration crackdowns, and a chilling effect that's hurting an industry that is already strapped for workers. Here's our conversation.
Well, you know, I've been in business in this fine city for 34 years, and I like to look at life from perspectives, and my perspective is one that lives on the ground and one that lives in the building where people work, and they come to eat, but I think there's a lot more to it that hospitality provides. And the hospitality worker throughout generations, you know, has been built by, you know, you come here and you work hard, and maybe one day, you know, your grandson will own a pizzeria in Phoenix and so on and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Or hopefully in a quicker time frame that you find happiness and health, you know, from whatever situation that you left. I've been lucky enough to have people that work with me that become American citizens, and seeing the joy that they, and the pride and the knowledge that they have is probably greater than mine about our American history, sadly enough. And for me, I think there's a lot of misconception about what immigrants bring to the table. And, you know, knowing that the hardworking good people that do the jobs that, you know, American kid don't want to do. And that's just, you know, the next, you know, a guy in a dish pit that wants to come, that's, you know, coming in from, you know, the suburbs,
mm-hmm.
For a summer job. It just doesn't happen. But what does happen to come in that we can E-Verify, and people that are newer to this country, or they might come to be, you know, relocated from a war zone or from South America, from any part of the world.
So what you're saying, this is an industry that's been built on immigrants.
Yeah, I mean, it is an industry that has not only been built by immigrants and held up by immigrants. And, you know, it is unequivocally, you know, living proof of the American dream. And they can happen, and they do happen. And these people pay taxes, and they work hard, and they're pillars in our society, you know. And I think, you know, unfortunately, there can be sound bites. There's bad apples in every, you know, basket. And of course, you know, bad apples need to be removed. But, you know, I think the fear that there'll be a lot of good apples caught up digging for bad ones. And, you know, we're still reeling from the pandemic. Like, I mean, you know, we're also in Los Angeles, and we're reeling from, you know, the fires and writer strikes. And, you know, the people that show up, hardworking people, they're looking at the news waiting for the next shoe to drop, whether mm-hmm. it be a pandemic or a mass deportation or some type of issue that will affect a positive, you know, society.
Right. So you've got a restaurant industry that is concerned about this because so many immigrants work in the industry. So many people come from mixed status families.
Yeah.
And you're saying you're still kind of coming off the heels of the pandemic. The restaurant industry is already strapped for workers, right?
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. Whatever, you know, the leadership of our country, what I know is I've been through Republican, Democrat, whatever. And I know the people just show up to work for me. You know, they come in all shades in all colors, and they speak sometimes languages that we might not understand at the beginning. But by the end of the day, those relationships grow and they become positive forces in society. And I think those are the stabilities in my life. Mm. Not so much outside forces, but the people that show up and do these jobs every day. And how can we make their lives better? How can they become contributing members of society in a world that is depleted of workers, you know, whether it's picking tomatoes or fruit or the, you know, jobs that are seasonal. You know, sometimes we don't understand the impact of our decisions. And I think we're flooded with sound bites and commercials and fear factors and horrible stories of incidents. And all of a sudden, you know, the world's turned upside down for these people. We just want to make people feel safe. The people that are on both sides of the pass, we say, like in the dining room, in the kitchen. You know, I've been a law-abiding citizen, and I intend to be. We do everything that we can do to verify, mm-hmm. to, you know, be accountable to the laws put in place. But I think it still doesn't change the factor. If someone does come from a compromised, maybe someone in their family or maybe their grandmother, their mother-in-law, whatever,
right.
they might not say, well, I can't risk to go into a restaurant. Maybe that'll connect me to my family. Even if it's unreasonable, the culture that the fear has created has not been a positive one for business, period, for the community, period.
So let me ask you about your willingness to talk about this, right? Like, it's political. Chefs around the country, I think, have been hesitant to talk about mass deportations, fear in the restaurant community and the world there. Mm-hmm. They don't want ICE targeting their restaurant, right? Like, are you worried about sticking your neck out there?
I don't see anything sticking my neck about anything. I mean, I like to be transparent. All I'm saying is there's a community, I think, that's very unsettled, that feeds our community. And I think if we can work together, whether it's jurisdictions or ICE or government or authority or whatever, to find, you know, peaceful and passive ways to hopefully, you know, restore more of a sense of peace, of calm. And, you know, the reality is there's no one stealing jobs. There's plenty of jobs. If you need one, you come on down. Well, I'm sure we can find one for you.
Yeah.
So I think that's the hard part for business is we don't have people to fill jobs and losing the largest aspect of our workforce, even if just by changing industry, mm-hmm. just by sometimes it's just, you know, it's by association, you know, just like for have maybe somebody wondering your status or your wife's status or your cousin. It's a difficult place to be in or put people in. And
so what can you tell folks? Like, what do you, is there advice? A lot of restaurant owners are giving out cards or putting up, you know, signs in the kitchens, things like that, to sort of inform people of the rights that they have in these situations.
Well, I think, you know, all our workers, regardless, are informed of their rights. And you know, like I said, I obey laws. Even talking about this is, you know, I don't see anything divisive about it. I don't see anything judgmental about it. I just think that there's people that are really good people that, you know, might be in the crossfire of something that's unintended for them, you know, and maybe that just pushes them out of an industry that's already in dire need of a workforce.
All right. Well, I appreciate you coming in. That is Chef Chris Bianco, chef and owner of Pizzeria Bianco, of course. Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Cheers.
A bill making its way through the state legislature would allow law enforcement to keep people suspected of being impaired by drugs who are arrested in involuntary custody for 5 days. Republican State Senator Vince Leach, the bill's sponsor, said at the state capitol recently that SB 1257 would help combat crime.
Everything that we've tried, everything that we're trying, the current system is expensive, but it's not working.
And Dr. Margie Balfour, who testified in support of the bill, says holding people in crisis centers for 5 days means there would be time for drugs, specifically meth, to clear from their system.
Give us time to engage with them, with peer support, try to enhance their motivation for treatment so that hopefully they would accept voluntary treatment.
But our next guest this morning calls this government overreach and an infringement on individual liberty. Jay Alexandria Hunt Garcia works with local nonprofit The Praxis Initiative, as well as the national group Dream.org, to advocate for criminal legal reform, and she is arguing against the bill. I spoke with her more about why.
It's really just an infringement on autonomy and trust, and forced detainment undermines voluntary care. I look at things from a harm reduction perspective, and coming from that angle, we really try to recognize the individuals who are struggling with substance use disorder or even just using substances must be able to choose their treatment path. And we see significantly higher levels of success when people are able to choose their treatment. And then looking at it from a fiscal perspective, in the bill, it's outlined that Access would be covering all of this forced detainment and treatment. And as many of us know, in the United States, we are expecting massive Medicaid cuts coming down the pipeline. You know, we're concerned that we're going to get to a point in the state where people are competing for Medicaid funding, and we don't want to get to a point where forced treatment is taking priority over individuals who are wanting to choose treatment.
Mm-hmm. So, right, you're talking about how this would be paid for by Access. That's Arizona's Medicaid program. They are signed in as neutral on this bill. I want to talk a little bit about another point that you mentioned there, which is the idea of who's targeted in things like this. Like, are you concerned about selective enforcement?
Absolutely. That is a huge concern of ours. People who use substances are already such a marginalized group. And as we've seen with many of the drug bills that we've seen in the past, we saw it with the crack cocaine bills, which, interestingly enough, there are Republican-led initiatives this year that are passing through the legislature to roll back some of those, you know, racist bills that had gone through many, many decades ago. So it's interesting to see that on one hand, they're trying to roll back these initiatives that did target marginalized communities, while also trying to pass bills that would likely do the same thing.
So you talked about individual freedoms. I also want to ask another kind of logistical question here, which is just, do we know where people would spend these 5 days that they're being held? Like, you've heard, I know from rehab facilities who are concerned about that.
So I've dug through the bill a lot. I have sent it to a couple attorneys who've gotten back to me. And there are pieces that specifically mention the state hospital. There's also a line in the bill that specifically mentions accredited facilities that have correctional accreditations, which concerns me that some individuals may actually end up in correctional facilities. But I haven't received any real solidified information from the sponsor yet to clarify that.
And we have reached out about that as well. We've seen a bill similar to this, although it holds folks for much longer, pass in one other state, at least Kentucky. Tell us what you know about what happened there.
Yeah, so I work on a lot of policy in Kentucky through my work at Dream.org and have a solid number of colleagues and coworkers who work there. The way that it works there is any individual can petition the courts for 365 days of forced treatment. From what I've heard from individuals who are deeply involved in the recovery communities there, just like any treatment opportunity that you see, there's always going to be one or two people who are successful, but they're using these one or two success cases to show like a blanket success of the entire program. But what we're hearing is that it's not successful. You know, at the end of the day, it really is no different than being in a correctional facility. People are being taken away from their careers. They're being taken away from their families. And realistically, we know that someone is at a significantly higher risk of overdose when coming out of a facility like that. So our concern is that if this starts to pick up steam across the country, that this could actually increase overdose rates.
Let me ask you about this idea of pushing someone into treatment involuntarily to begin with. Do you think that's something that is often successful by a law that's passed by the state legislature or by a family member or by anyone?
So we have a lot of data on forced treatment, and we know that it's not effective. So that is where it really gets challenging, is when you have people who are afraid that their children are going to die, or they're afraid that their loved ones aren't going to make it out of a substance use disorder. It's very hard because they're being driven by emotion, but we know through data and facts but it simply isn't effective.
What would you rather see the legislature focus on when it comes to addressing addiction in the state of Arizona? We're still in an opioid epidemic. We still are seeing rates of fentanyl use and overdoses too high.
I think when we look at Arizona, there is a ton of opportunity for how we can combat the overdose crisis. I think for a lot of people, legislators, people who are in power, it's going to take stepping out of their comfort zone and maybe taking some time to look at, you know, the things that they have learned over the years, putting that down on paper with what we now know through evidence is effective for treatment, and working together to find solutions that we know work through evidence. There are a lot of different ways that that could happen. Investing in our communities, ensuring that people have their basic needs met, even, you know, adhering to the federal methadone guidelines that were changed last year. Clinics have done an incredible job of working to make those changes, which it can take a long time to, you know, start to align with a federal rule change. That's a lot of work, I understand. But our people who are struggling with substance use disorder still have so many barriers they have to overcome that we have the tools to help remove those barriers. We just haven't done so. And I think that that needs to happen if we want to see a significant drop in overdose deaths.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. That is Jay Alexandria Hunt Garcia, campaign organizer at Dream.org, as well as director of policy with the Praxis Initiative here in Arizona, lobbying against this bill. Thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's great talking to you.
We also reached out to the bill's sponsor, Senator Vince Leach, who told us in a written statement that people held under this law would be placed at the Crisis Recovery Center that is specifically for Title 36 patients, where they feel there is capacity. Right now, he says someone who comes into the center can stay voluntarily for about a day, but when they're released, they, quote, go out and relapse and come back in, creating a cycle. With this approach, an individual can come in and receive treatment for 5 days for essentially the same cost and have a much better chance at getting better and breaking the cycle. We'll post his full statement on our website, theshow.kjzz.org. We also reached out to Access, Arizona's Medicaid program, but have not received a response. Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, an art photographer turns the lens on his ancestral homeland in an ongoing project. But first, Republican lawmakers at the state capitol and Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs have not agreed on much this session, but it looks like they might be inching closer to striking an all-important deal to extend Prop 123, the 2016 ballot measure Arizona voters narrowly approved to boost school funding amid a teacher shortage and school funding crisis. The maneuvers come as the proposition, which pulls money for schools from the state's land trust fund, is set to expire this summer, and time is running out this year to hold a special election to let voters approve its extension. KJZZ's Wayne Shutsky is covering it all for our politics desk and joins us now with more. Hi there, Wayne.
Good morning.
Okay, so at the beginning of this legislative session at the state capitol, I remember there were just a few things folks were talking about lawmakers had to accomplish, like a budget, and extending Prop 123 was one of them. It sounds like we're getting closer to a deal.
Yeah, the governor introduced her plan yesterday, which for those that don't remember Prop 123, it's something that was passed 10 years ago, and it basically boosted the amount of money schools get from the state land trust fund that's funded by sales of land that the state owns from about 2.5% to almost 7%. Mm-hmm. And so the governor wants to continue that for about 10 years and additionally raise that base level funding on the bottom from 2.5 up a few more percentage points.
Okay. We also have a GOP proposal that is slightly different, it sounds like.
Yeah, but they're getting closer together. The GOP wants to also continue it for another 10 years and raise that base level. It's just they want to do it by about a percentage less than the governor. So that's, you know, Now we're cooking. That sounds like a negotiation's happening.
Yeah. What is the concern on the Republican side? Like, they want to raise teacher pay, but they don't want to take so much from the state land trust that it isn't sustainable, essentially, into the future?
Yeah, a lot of Republican lawmakers have kind of stuck to that 6.9% that's already being taken out for a while now. But there are a few, State Treasurer Kimberly Yee's one of them, who are saying, whoa, wait a second, let's do a lower level. The fund is growing right now. It's doing really well. But if we have an economic crisis or something in the future, we don't want to start taking so much money out of this fund that it's drawing back. And so they want a lower level. So What J.D. Mesnard, the Republican senator who's backing one of these bills, said is basically this kind of is walking that fine line, continues it at that higher rate right now. And then in the future, it could it'll keep a nice sustainable level of funding that's higher than the 2.5%, but maybe not quite as high as the 6.9%, meeting in the middle there.
Meeting in the middle. A lot of numbers here. But basically, this is the governor coming down on what she had originally wanted, it sounds like.
Yeah. Hobbs last year had backed a plan wanting to go all the way up to almost 9% and, you know, to fund a whole array of educational funding sources. So she's back definitely coming closer to where Republicans are at on this.
All right. So it sounds like the two sides, though, still disagree on just how this money, whatever amount it ends up being, should be spent. Like, the GOP lawmakers want it specifically and only to go to teacher raises.
That's right. Right now, Prop 123 monies go to lots of different educational things at the district. But as you said, Republicans say, no, teachers need raises in Arizona. Let's throw all this money to that. They say that would give teachers about a $4,000 a year raise. And so that's kind of what they've stuck with. They've been saying that for over a year now. The governor is looking at something a little bit different. She wants a portion of it to be set aside for teacher raises and other stuff going to more general school funding that goes to the district, the base level, basically they receive for all their expenses, as well as something called a classroom site fund. Some of that can also be used for teacher raises and performance pay and that kind of stuff, but it also goes to other support services like counselors and that kind of thing.
Hmm. And of course, Arizona, you know, has been in a teacher shortage crisis for quite some time now. This is, I'm sure, aimed at fixing this problem.
Yeah, I mean, lots of surveys and reports and all these different things we see, you know, they keep coming back to one thing as the biggest driver of the shortage, and it's pay. And that isn't just teachers. That's most jobs, right? You pay people more, they're more likely to come to this profession, especially a profession like teaching, which, you know, can be difficult. You know, your kids aren't always the easiest to work with.
It's a hard job.
And there's a lot of, you know, work that goes in beyond inside the classroom, after hours, all that kind of thing.
Yeah. Okay, so this would have to go to voters, though, at some point here. Wayne, is there still time for that this year?
Depending on who you ask, yes or no, but we're likely, even if someone says there is time, we're getting close. You know, it would have to go to a special election in May, and a lot of election officials have said they need more time than we even have left to do that. That being said, lawmakers can still refer it to the ballot in 2026. Now, it does expire in June of this year, but there's some funding mechanisms in there to backfill the funding that would be lost to schools. So it's not like a funding cliff where come June, they're going to lose this money if it's not renewed before then.
Okay, so there is a little bit of a contingency plan there should the May election not happen. Some people think it would fare better on kind of a regular ballot during a regular election cycle than during a special election, too.
Yeah, that's what I heard from Republican Representative Matt Gress. He's another one pushing one of these bills. And he basically, you know, special elections, the turnout is low. And so this passed by a super slim margin last time, about 51% of the vote. And so, you know, I think they want to, they think it's popular to say, hey, let's boost teacher pay.
Yeah.
But if you don't have a lot of people coming out, then you're not, it's harder to gauge who's coming out to vote in that election. I think they think with a general election, when more people are likely to show up at the ballots, they can make that broader argument to a large swath of people that, hey, this is a good thing. Let's boost teacher pay. Let's get this across the finish line.
Do they think that is why this vote was pretty narrow when it originally passed?
I don't know that they think that's the only reason. You know, this was a very different environment back when we were doing it. I think the other argument they're making is teacher pay is an easy sell to voters, whereas the original Prop 123 was for a whole range of academic costs and educational costs at districts. So that's kind of one thing that Mesnard, the Republican senator, told me as well, is he's like, not only do I think it's good policy to make this just for teacher pay, but I just think it's an easier thing to tell voters, like, you know, you like teachers, we like teachers, let's get them some more money.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Lots to watch for still. KJZZ's Wayne Shetsky with our politics desk joining us. Wayne, thanks so much.
Yep, thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Researchers have found a treasure trove of structures from an ancient civilization by using a modern technology. Luke Auld Thomas is an instructor in the anthropology department at NAU and a PhD candidate at Tulane University. He, along with some colleagues at schools in both the U.S. and Mexico, analyzed a survey of land in Mexico done by LIDAR, and they found evidence of more than 6,500 structures from the Maya civilization. My co-host Mark Brody spoke with Auld Thomas recently about the find and what it could mean for the future, starting with how common it is to be able to use LIDAR to do this kind of work in the worlds of archaeology and anthropology.
It's actually becoming quite common. Archaeology depends on being able to see what's on the ground, or ideally be able to see what's under the ground, which is often what we're most interested in. But that starts out with being able to see what's on top of the ground and the shape of the ground. If you imagine, you know, a group of houses that have been abandoned for 1,000 years, all of the perishable bits rot, all of the non-perishable bits fall apart, and you end up with basically a lump of rocks and other non-perishable material that gradually gets covered by soil. And so archaeologists that are interested in mapping ancient settlements, where people lived, how they were organized, how they managed their landscapes, whether through agriculture, infrastructure, or something else, were very interested in mapping these minor changes in topography or terrain across large areas. LIDAR allows us to do that.
So you're looking at this image and you're able to, you know, take away digitally foliage and other stuff you don't want. Is it just a matter of you notice some mounds or lumps on the ground and said, we should go check those out?
Yeah, pretty much. The longer you work in a particular part of the world, the quicker you become able to recognize distinctive kinds of topographic things as being made by people. If you imagine looking at a map just of elevation in a town in the United States, you know, say Phoenix, if you see a really long, narrow depression with raised bits of ground on either side, well, you're probably looking at a canal. And so we're basically doing that, but with ancient Maya houses, ancient Maya temples, palaces, ball courts, reservoirs, all of those kind of things. If you look at enough of them on the ground and on maps of sites that were made by archaeologists working in the 19th and 20th centuries, you very quickly become able to pick out what these things look like as topographic signatures. And then it's just a process of going through manually. And we still do this manually. There is work focused on developing AI models that can take over some of the heavy lifting for us. But for the time being, it's an entirely manual process of just going through and drawing all of these features and interpreting them.
So when it occurred to you that there might be something there, did you know at that time how many structures there might be? I mean, you found more than 6,000 previously unseen structures. Did you know it was going to be that big of a deal?
No, it was really fortuitous. What happened was that I went looking for LIDAR data sets that might already exist, because since it measures everything that the laser interacts with, LIDAR data is very useful for people who study forests. And so I figured that somebody out there had probably mapped parts of the Maya region for environmental or engineering purposes, and that data was probably just sitting around. And after looking long enough, I turned up one such data set that was collected by a group of ecologists in 2013, focused on mapping trees in Mexico. So they collected all of this data on areas that were essentially archaeologically unmapped stretches of tropical forest. And they looked at the trees and they didn't really spend that much time or energy thinking about what was under the trees. And I, as an archaeologist, came through and did exactly the opposite, where I immediately removed all of the trees and focused my effort on making sense of what was underneath them. And it was a matter of seconds between when I opened up the data on my computer and when I realized just what a gold mine of archaeological information it was going to turn out to be.
So what does this discovery tell us about the Mayan civilization? Like, what do we know now that we didn't know before? And maybe do we have to change the way we think about the Mayans?
Yeah, I think that there are two answers to that question. The first is an academic one, and the second is maybe more of a popular understanding of people outside of the scientific community think about Maya civilization. For archaeologists, having been able to identify such a high level of regional scale settlement density, and having, through the equivalent of a thrown dart hitting the map, found a really large city in such a almost hilariously obvious location, right next to the highway, right next to a modern town, I think that that really underscores that there is not a lot of empty space in the unmapped parts of the Maya lowlands. So we have lots of blank spots on the map. And what that does not mean, categorically does not mean, is that there's nothing there. What this kind of research shows for archaeologists is that those blank areas are just going to be full of more of the same kind of stuff that we've been mapping for the last 100 years. It's a thoroughly urbanized landscape. Now, for kind of broader understanding of Maya civilization in popular culture and popular understanding, what I hope that this research can contribute to is an appreciation that Maya cities are not little clutches of temples and palaces surrounded by jungle, but rather that the entire region was utterly urbanized, a sort of a popular version of the realization that archaeologists have been coming to. But what that means for the way that we as a society think about ancient civilizations is that a lot of parts of the world that are currently regarded as wilderness have not always been wilderness, and that these areas were thick with people.
So what's next then? I mean, I would imagine it's a combination of potentially more LIDAR mapping and also, as you referenced, getting in the field and really trying to see what these structures might have been like. What for you is next?
There are two things that I hope happen next. And, you know, both of these things are already underway from our project and others, but I hope it inspires this more broadly in the archaeological community. First, I hope that this work shows the value of archaeologists and environmental scientists collaborating more closely in questions of remote sensing. And the other thing that's going to happen is that sensor technology has been developing and improving really quickly. And so the areas that we can map are getting bigger, and the quality of the data that we can collect across those areas is getting greater. And so I don't think it's a matter of very much time at all before we're talking about, you know, national scale wall-to-wall mapping, where we don't even have to worry about found data sets or samples anymore, because we'll have just been able to map the entire thing. And I think that's really exciting and also a little poignant, because it means that thrill of discovery and the lure of the unknown, at least for some of these parts of the world, will at that point be largely used up, because we'll know what's there.
All right. That is Luke Auld Thomas, an instructor in the anthropology department at NAU, a PhD candidate at Tulane University in New Orleans. Luke, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for speaking with me. I appreciate your time.
And now let's travel out of the valley and maybe even out of this realm to Sedona, which has been known for decades as the nation's New Age capital, where spiritual pilgrims come to explore supernatural vortex sites to find proof of the paranormal. But how did it get this storied and scientifically questioned reputation? Longtime Arizona journalist Annette McGivney traced its history and future in a new piece for Arizona Highways, and she's on the line now to tell us more. Good morning, Annette.
Yes, good morning.
So you, I know, have hiked the Red Rocks for decades all over, but you finally decided to kind of find out what it is about Sedona that has earned this supernatural reputation we've all probably heard of. And you began by going on a UFO tour. Can you tell us about that and what you saw?
Yes. So it was probably a lot of people that have visited Sedona and seen the signs or the vans that say UFO tours have wondered about it. And so I just finally decided to take the leap and contacted Sedona UFO Tours and met this guy named Michael in a parking lot with other Sedona visitors. Mm-hmm. And we drove up to the top of Airport Mesa, and he put these stools out on the ground, and we all sat there, and he gave us night vision goggles and instructed us about what we were seeing up in the night sky. And I had never used night vision goggles before, so I was surprised. I was surprised. There was a lot of activity up there that I was not aware of when I look at the stars with my naked eye.
Right. So whether or not those are spaceships is up for debate, but an interesting tour nonetheless. Take us back in history a little bit here. This reputation for the paranormal is relatively new, historically speaking, in Sedona. Like, it used to be a sleepy ranching town in the 60s, and then in the 70s and early 80s, it sounds like a psychic came there and kind of changed everything.
That's right. You know, I think maybe hippies in the 1970s had been coming to Sedona because of its beautiful landscape, but it was not until the 1980s when a psychic named Paige Bryant was visiting Sedona, and she just declared that certain places were what she called vortexes. Mm. And there was no historic precedent for that. She was not drawing from anything other than what she said she intuited from the land. And she described these as places that had a spiritual or mystical type of energy emanating from specific spots in around Sedona. And, you know, coincidentally, she was not like a wilderness backpacker. Right. So all the vortexes are conveniently almost like about within 1 mile from the road.
Okay. And these vortices, right? Like, it's only gotten more popular, more people on the trails, more tourists visiting, millions every year who come to kind of hike out to these. And you write about how they kind of put public land managers in a kind of awkward position, because from a scientific perspective, of course, there's nothing there.
Right. You know, how we experience the landscape is very subjective. And, you know, for some people, they may be looking for scientifically proven species and things like that. Others may be looking for something that's far more transcendent. And so the Forest Service isn't sure how to answer that question. So they don't give, you know, direct answers saying vortexes are not real, mm-hmm. but they do try to encourage or support alternative uses on the Coconino National Forest in Sedona, which means that if people want to meditate, you know, that's as valid a use as mountain biking, but they do have to, you know, keep it from harming the resource. So too much traffic of people going to visit vortexes damages the environment, or, you know, a New Age guide playing flute music mm-hmm. can interrupt the experience of others. So the Forest Service has come up with a guiding permit system where New Age or, you know, vortex type guides have to get a permit from the Forest Service to lead tours. And the Forest Service tries to prevent the guides from saying anything that's like too out there, I guess, like saying that there's definitely like UFOs that have landed on Secret Mountain. Like, there's no, the Forest Service, like, that's too far out there.
Okay. Okay. And you also write about another downside of all of this, like the appropriation of Native American spirituality, this idea of linking New Age beliefs to indigenous cultures and how it's downright offensive to some tribes.
Right. That's right. You know, the UFO thing, it's like, all right, whatever, you know, it can be kind of funny or what, you know, like it's not proven, but it's not really harming anyone. But the part about the Sedona tourism industry that, you know, borrows or claims knowledge about Native American cultures, especially the indigenous cultures of the Sedona landscape, which are the Yavapai and the Apache, is harmful to the Yavapai and Apache and more broadly to Native Americans, because appropriating their culture can lead one people to believe that the Native American people that have lived there for 1,000 years are no longer there anymore. Mm. But they are, like, they were forced onto a reservation just south of Sedona. And so history is obscured. And then the practice of selling or profiting from Native American cultural practices by non-Native people is also harmful to Native people, because for them, you know, it would be like someone selling communion to us, you know, like it's selling spiritual practices. It's very offensive to Native American people.
That's really interesting. Okay, so we have about a minute left. And I just want to ask you lastly about your impressions coming away from this experience and what you heard from people, how you felt about this sort of metaphysical or, you know, spiritual, supernatural side of Sedona. What draws people there? Is it the freedom to explore the possibilities?
Right. I think, you know, I definitely, in writing the story, did not want to come across as judgmental about people who come to Sedona specifically to experience the vortexes or, you know, the mystical reputation of the landscape, because, you know, they're not from the area. And it's true, you know, when you see the sunset in Sedona, it is a transcendent experience. And so I guess, like, I wanted to encourage people to appreciate that transcendent experience without harming Native cultures or perhaps being taken advantage of by, you know, some guide that's claiming things that are not true.
Yeah. All right. We will leave it there for now. That is longtime Arizona journalist and writer Annette McGivney. The piece appears in Arizona Highways. Annette, thank you so much for coming on. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Lauren.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Marcus Cormichael's work has been shown in galleries throughout the Southwest. He's a fine art photographer, but he didn't start out that way. As a photojournalism student at ASU, he spent years honing a revealing personal style of photography that captured the lived experience of people and places. As he got older, though, he realized he wasn't that interested in other people and other places. He wanted to turn the lens on his people and his ancestral home. Cormichael recently spoke with the show's Sam Dingman.
My perspective on art making is that you're always looking to express something internal in an external way. And so I wanted to elaborate on my internal state, my lived experience. And so I began coming back home to Las Cruces, where I grew up, in order to photograph my own family as a way of kind of getting to the root of some internal states of being. And so I was still working in the kind of documentary style that was not too dissimilar from what I was doing in journalism. But by exploring these things that had such close relation to my own self, I was able to kind of express that a little bit more.
Yeah. I'm really interested in this because it seems like what you're saying, if I'm understanding correctly, is wanting to bring the style of documentary to work where you were not an objective observer.
Correct. Yeah. And photography's power comes from this value that is made when the artist makes the decision to take a photograph. You know, you're deciding what to include in the frame and tell folks, like, this is significant, it's worth looking at and thinking about and considering.
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons I'm curious to ask you about these kind of philosophical underpinnings, I know that an issue that you have wrestled with in one of your early projects, which was called Still Playing with Fire, which really confronted the deaths of three people who were very meaningful to you. When you showed these images, as I've heard you say, quote, most of the people in the family were receptive, but not all the people in your life were receptive. Can you tell me what that experience was like?
Yeah, I mean, I think that project, Still Playing with Fire, is about a lot of the dysfunction within my own family and connecting the root of those things to the colonial legacy of the New Mexico territories and bringing into focus the contemporary ways that people of indigenous or Chicano heritage in the New Mexico territories of what is now the United States are contending with those things. And so, yeah, I've been put into situations where family members don't realize that they're no longer happy with the photos, and it's kind of blown up at times in ways. And I think that that's part of making work that kind of hits at a certain point.
Absolutely. But it also strikes me as a noteworthy departure from your journalistic training, because there is this idea in journalism that the work that comes from interaction with sources is not then editorially approved by those sources. but you're talking about trying to tell an important public-facing story, but also trying to do that in a way that doesn't interfere with the lives of the people who are part of that story.
I think that a lot of it has to do with the person who's making the statement. So the photographer, the journalist, the artist, and their place in the community that they're making work. It's really easy to not have as many dilemmas if you aren't connected or a part of the community that you're making work about.
And, of course, yeah.
When you are, it comes with a different level of accountability. You know, my work's about my family, that my family's experienced, and it's real life. It's lived experience. It's not just abstract. It's seeing your own, yeah, your own experience of the world reflected to you. That is hard.
Well, let's talk then about the transition between the Still Playing with Fire project and this new work, Say Uncle, which is about trying to make work that does not necessarily emanate from a place of tragedy.
Yeah, I mean, for me, that is in the process. I think that Say Uncle still, you know, I'm still addressing the colonial legacy of photography, of representation, of Seki, the place, where my family is from.
If I understand correctly, this came out of these walks that you would take around this area with your uncle. Do you feel like you were seeing it through different eyes?
A lot of it comes from responding to stories he's told me while on those walks or outside of the walks, and hearing about his connection, about my other family's connections to these places there on the land where, you know, my family, my ancestors, or our relatives have stood for time immemorial. And so that connection is what I'm seeing in for myself, and also imagining what he had seen, my uncle, and what all of our family and ancestors have seen, hearing their mostly positive stories about being in that space and appreciating how special it is to have a connection to a place that goes back as many generations as there have ever been, and being able to appreciate that continuity.
Yeah. Well, so how much do you think about, as an artist, a non-Indigenous person, generally speaking, is not going to see the same history that you are able to see by virtue of your relationship to the land? Do you feel any pressure to explain that?
I am trying to address other Native folks first, and beyond that, anyone else who appreciates the work, that's kind of icing on the cake at that point. I like the idea of there being different interpretations of it and people having different access points to it. I think healthy culture has entry points and exit points. And I think that that's kind of a special thing about looking at other artists when you identify with them, is you can kind of guess what's in their head, and the closer you are to seeing yourself in them, maybe the more rich that's going to be.
Yeah. So how much do those ideas that you were just expressing inform this first public showing of the work, which is going to happen on March 7th, and it's going to be on your uncle's allotment on the reservation where some of the photographs were taken?
Yeah, I think that the opportunity to make work with my own family on our shared ancestral homeland and then show it there, independent of institutions or anything other than our own agency, is really significant. It's something that only Native people in this continent have the ability to do. I, of course, have the desire to share it more broadly, but I think that...
Well, and to be clear, right, the exhibition is open to anyone who wants to come. It's just that you're giving primacy to a certain audience by virtue of the location you've selected of where it's being shown.
Correct. And the secondary audience, if you find your own connection in it, it's quite a great privilege. And I've had that experience with a lot of artists who represent communities that I'm not a part of. And I want to speak directly to my family and my relatives in that way.
Well, Marcus Xavier Cormichael is a photographer, and the location of this exhibition of his work, this project is called Say Uncle, will be revealed on his website, cormichael.com. Marcus, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you. I really appreciate you giving me the space to speak.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.